Support for WPR comes from The Alliance, committed to being an objective partner for over 425 employers and their brokers, providing self-funded employers with data to manage their health plans. The-Alliance.org. Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, a community where students are invited to learn actively, lead courageously, and live purposefully for a lifetime of impact. More about Luther College at luther.edu.
Are you dealing with chronic pain right now? You're not alone. Tens of millions of Americans live with chronic pain, sometimes excruciating and disabling chronic pain, making it our nation's biggest health problem, according to our guest this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will talk about pain and the effective management of pain and why we can't seem to control pain in this country. And we will welcome your questions and your experiences. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Judy Foreman, a nationally syndicated health columnist and author of A Nation in Pain, Healing Our Biggest Health Problem. Thank you very much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
So tell us how you got started down this path in writing this book. You had your own pain issue, didn't you?
I did. I did not set out in life to have pain or write a book about it, I can tell you. But a few years ago, I came down for fairly mysterious reasons, at least mysterious to me, with severe, debilitating neck pain. After a bunch of doctor's visits, it turned out to be something called spondylolisthesis, which is a mouthful, but it means your vertebrae are kind of sliding forward over each other, getting way out of alignment. I also had bone spurs and degenerating discs in my spine. And the net result was, the slightest little movement of my head would cause this excruciating pain. And the constant nerve stimulation of my trapezius muscle meant that that was always going into spasm as well, to the point that those spasming muscles tipped my head over toward my left shoulder so much that I had to use my hands, both hands, to get my neck back up, my head back up where it was supposed to be. So that was called cervical dystonia.
Oh, that sounds terrible. What did this experience tell you about, I guess, the pain management system?
It told me it was really not up to the job. I mean, I went to a number of different doctors, and, one of them seemed very, very nice at the beginning, and then the more my pain did not get better, the more she seemed to get angry at me and frustrated with me, and it was really very, very frustrating. And I wrote, at the time I was writing a weekly column for the Boston Globe, my home paper, and I wrote about my pain and the troubles I had getting it treated. And the column got such a big response that's why I decided to go on and write a book.
Yeah, well, why is it so hard for the doctors you see, the doctors that many of us see, to take care of we have a pain in the back or a pain in the neck or some sort of pain. Why is it so hard to take care of it?
Well, first of all, pain is a complex phenomenon biologically, and I definitely would like to get into that in a minute. And here we're really talking the whole book and hopefully this whole show about chronic pain. We're not talking about the pain you get when you're having a baby, which is acute, although very real, or when you've just broken your arm. This is pain that becomes chronic. But the real reason doctors have so much trouble treating it is they don't know anything about it. Well, let me backtrack a second. They don't know much about it. In 4 years of medical school, they get a median of 9 hours of education about basic, mechanisms of pain. So that's almost nothing, given that pain is a bigger problem for the country than heart disease, cancer, and diabetes combined. And it's the main reason people go to doctors. So here's this huge need on the part of patients. And doctors really don't know as much as they should. In fact, they don't learn as much in medical school as veterinary students learn in veterinary school. And this, I'm not making up these numbers. The medical school number comes from a big study at Johns Hopkins in 2011. And there's a number of studies showing that veterinary students get more pain education than doctors.
And why do you say that pain or pain management or lack of pain management is one of the most urgent health problems in America?
Because so many people have it. According to a major report from the Institute of Medicine, which I'm sure you know is part of the National Academy of Sciences, Congress asked the Institute of Medicine a couple of years ago to get a handle on the chronic pain problem, and they did. It's actually fairly readable for a government document or a government-sponsored document. And they came up with the fact that 100 million Americans, adults, are living in chronic pain, and that number may actually be an underestimate, big as it sounds, because that doesn't include kids or people in nursing homes or people in the military. So there's a lot of people in pain. Not all of them are in excruciating, debilitating pain like I was for the time I had it, about 8 months. But many are, and the estimates are from 10% to 30% of this huge number, 100 million, are living in severe disabling pain. That's a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, why don't they all just take some prescription drugs and take care of that pain?
Well, I have two chapters in the book devoted to what we call officially it's called the opioid, which is basically narcotics, opioid conundrum. I call it the opioid mess. We have basically two colliding epidemics in this country. We have, as I've just been talking about, a huge epidemic of chronic pain, but we also have a smaller but also troubling epidemic of drug abuse, including prescription painkillers. So these two epidemics are basically colliding, and the government is essentially only dealing with the drug abuse epidemic, not the chronic pain epidemic. And it's really a mess, because the bottom line is that people who use OxyContin and a whole slew of other opioid pain relievers, people who use them illegally and not to control pain but to get high, they're the ones who are basically getting in trouble with the drugs in terms of overdoses and deaths. And so everybody's cracking down on the availability of these drugs, which is not exactly the right answer, because it means that pain patients, the legitimate people who really do want pain control, are having an increasingly hard time getting the drugs that would help them.
Well, this is a quick story, something that happened to me in Florida. A relative who had, I was helping through hip replacement surgery, was prescribed OxyContin as he was discharged from the hospital, and trying to pick that prescription up at the drugstores or the pharmacies in Florida was almost impossible. They said
That's
they
right.
didn't have it in stock. And it was like, well, what's going on here? It turns out they don't want to have it in stock because they don't want to be robbed, or I'm not sure what.
Yep, that's exactly right. And actually, Florida has one of the worst situations with all that. And Walgreens, the huge, I think it's the nation's biggest drug chain, has instituted a policy that, maybe for good intentions, but it's also making it very, very hard for pain patients, because their policy is that any pain prescription, they have to call the doctor to check. So it's becoming up to a pharmacist to decide whether the patient needs the drugs, and that's not the appropriate way to do medicine, and it's definitely making it much, much harder for people like your example to get the pain meds that are appropriately prescribed and that the patients need.
Yeah, and then as you mentioned in your story, you can go to, if you go to the doctor because you have pain, sometimes you're viewed as some sort of addict trying to get pain meds.
Yes, you are very, very often viewed as a drug seeker. In fact, from my own experience, I can say don't even bother going to the emergency room with chronic pain, because you will be seen as a drug seeker. I have a number of really tragic examples in the book of people who, you know, just went from emergency room to emergency room, people without a primary care doc, looking for relief for pain, and they got turned away or given a short amount of prescription length, you know, for drugs. And then when they ran out, they had to go back and just not believed. And in one case, I talked to a guy who kept being dissed by, you know, emergency room after emergency room. They had him so convinced that he was a drug seeker, he wound up in the psych ward of a hospital in a group for Narcotics Anonymous. And he couldn't believe it. These people were talking about things like they'd sell a kidney to get a drug, they'd rob the drugstore, and he was thinking, that's not me. I don't want to do those things. I don't want to get high. I just want to get rid of the pain. And that is a very, very common story for people with chronic pain.
Oh, so what is the answer to this? These conflicting epidemics?
Well, there's two big answers, two sort of infrastructure answers. One is to dramatically beef up the amount of pain education that doctors get in medical school, because if they really understood the mechanics of it biologically better, they would be less likely to dismiss people as lying or faking or trying to get drugs. The other sort of big infrastructure thing is the government spends almost no money on basic pain research. In the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, which is like the big medical research arm of the government, they spend only 1.1% of their massive budget on pain research. And, you know, that's crazy, given that it affects 100 million people and it's a bigger problem than cancer, heart disease, and diabetes combined. In fact, I just came across some new statistics, or new to me. Chronic pain, the government spends $4 for every person on chronic pain, which is, you know, not even a latte. And for HIV/AIDS, which affects only 1 million people as opposed to 100 million, they spend $2,500. So it's a huge disproportion. Chronic pain is basically barely noticed by the National Institutes of Health, and doctors don't learn about it. So those are two huge structural things in society that we really should address if this is going to change.
Yeah. Isn't there a new pain reliever on the market now that people can take, and is that going to help?
I assume you're talking about Zohydro,
yeah,
which has been approved by the FDA. And there's a lot of protest from a group of doctors who are opposed to opioids. And their attitude is, you know, why do we need yet another opioid on the market when we're having so much trouble already with the ones we've got? It's a legitimate point. But the answer, which I think is also valid, is that this Zohydro is opioid alone. It doesn't have combined with it acetaminophen. That's the stuff in Tylenol.
Right.
And believe it or not, it's the acetaminophen in a lot of these combination drugs that is the dose-limiting problem, because it's very easy to get too much acetaminophen in your system, and that really does cause a lot of liver problems and hospitalization. So, you know, conceptually it makes sense to have an acetaminophen-free drug on the market. Politically, it's a disaster to have another opioid on the market. So it's you know, scientifically it makes sense, but politically it's really it's a mess.
Why is it a mess politically?
Because it's such a war between the people who are trying to treat pain patients fairly and give them the maximal number of drugs available, and the doctors who are opposed essentially to all opioids. It's a very hotly contested and very politicized area.
Yeah. Are there any other areas other than, you know, prescription pain relievers that other courses that, you know, that patients can take?
Oh, yes. And, you know, although I devote two chapters of the book to opioids, the whole rest of the book is about other things that people can do. Let me just backtrack for 1 second to define for your listeners what happens with chronic pain. Then I'll go into some of the treatments that can work. And, you know, I have to say, nothing is a real slam dunk except perhaps exercise. But if you add all these things together, you can get significant help. Pain is officially defined as an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience that is, people think of in terms of tissue damage. What that's acute pain. What is chronic pain is not just this kind of pain that I just described that lasts for 3 to 6 months or longer, but chronic pain really involves a transformation of the entire nervous system. It's like learning French or learning to play the piano. The more you practice, the more efficient and better you get at it. Well, that's what happens with pain. The more your nerves convey pain signals up to your brain, the better and better and more efficient they get at it until it becomes like a runaway freight train, and it becomes a disease in its own right. And that's what most doctors don't understand. They still think of chronic pain as a symptom of something else, but it isn't. It's a disease in its own right. So in terms of treating it with things other than opioids, and I do think that should be the main emphasis for most people if they can manage it, there's a lot of traditional medicine treatments, including surgery and injections, which have a mixed track record. There's a lot of meditation can be very, very helpful for pain. Exercise is probably the closest thing to a magic bullet for people with chronic pain. That really works, and it seems to work by desensitizing this runaway nervous system and kind of makes that revved up system slow down a bit until it becomes more or less normal. Acupuncture can help a lot. Massage helps some people. Chiropractic helps some people. I mean, there's a whole slew of things that we can go into more if you want.
We will. And we will invite our listeners to ask their questions or to share their experiences with chronic pain. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Judy Foreman, a nationally syndicated health columnist, author of the new book, A Nation in Pain, Healing Our Biggest Health Problem. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about pain this hour and the management of pain, and talking about why there are so many people with chronic pain problems in this nation that are not being effectively treated. Our guest is the author of A Nation in Pain, Healing Our Biggest Health Problem. And our first caller for her is Steve in Prentice. Hello, Steve.
Hi.
Go ahead, Steve.
Hi, Judy. Nice to meet you. I'm from Michigan and just recently moved to Wisconsin. I have a few friends that are actually on pain management contracts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, me coming from Michigan, I had a medical marijuana card, and I used medical marijuana for pain. And it really did help me. And I get up here, and I find that all these places are having the pain management contracts, which really... I went to get on one myself, and I really felt that it made me feel like I was on probation or always being watched. Which, to me, I'm a grown person. I'm an adult. I seek out help for my pain because I had pain. I would not go to a doctor and say I didn't have pain if I didn't have pain. And I know for a fact that 65% of all Americans are walking around on opiates. And that means whether addicted to opiates, and that could be heroin off the streets or prescription drugs out of grandma's closet or just from the doctor, vice versa, from accidents. I can understand that it is a problem for our nation. And can it be helped? I really don't think so, because as human beings in our own bodies, we have opiate receptors in our brains. So why do we have an opiate receptor if it's not supposed to accept the opiate?
Steve, we've got a lot of things that we can chew on here.
There's a lot embedded in your in what you said. First of all, I don't recognize that figure that 65% of Americans are walking around on some kind of opiates. I can't vouch for that. That doesn't sound right to me, but so I respectfully can't get into that one. You are completely correct. Biologically, we are all born with opioid receptors for our own types of opioids that we make in our body. Those are called endorphins, and the receptors are receptors, little places where the endorphins fit. We also are all born with marijuana-like receptors. We have a lot of receptors for cannabinol and cannabidiol, and those we're born with, and we were also born with substances in our body that are like marijuana and that fit into those receptors. So clearly we are wired to have a pain control system within our own bodies. Obviously, when you have very intense pain, this system isn't enough to help completely, although it helps somewhat. The first issue you brought up was about contracts that many doctors are now asking pain patients to sign, and they're very controversial, and it's not clear at all whether they help. It help meaning make a dent in the opioid abuse problem. It's certainly reasonable for a doctor and a patient to talk about how to take certain meds, how not to increase your doses without checking with the doctor, how not to mix the drugs with other drugs, to the extent that the contracts spell out those sort of safe ways of taking the drugs. That's good, but it's ethically a really tricky thing because, as you said, making a patient sign a contract for these particular drugs is something we don't do for any other kind of drugs. And it does stigmatize patients, and it does make them feel like they're criminals when all they're trying to do is get rid of their pain. So I think that's a really important point, and I'm glad you brought it up because although I deal with it in the book, a lot of people in my talks around the country have not glommed onto that and picked that up, and I'm really glad you did.
Yeah, and do you think that medical marijuana helps people in pain or not?
Do I, Judy?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I wasn't going to include marijuana in my book because I already had enough stuff, but I kept doing research and I found that there was so much on marijuana that I actually devote a whole separate chapter to it. It's like opioids, like exercise, like acupuncture, like everything else. It is not 100% cure, but it probably reduces pain on average about 30%, which is in line, interestingly, with how much the opioids can reduce pain. You know, they can knock pain down from a 10 on a scale of 10 to a 6 or 7. That's not getting rid of it, although it makes your life manageable. Same with marijuana, and the medical marijuana patients I talk to, they say an interesting thing, which is confirmed to some degree by the research, and that is that sensorily, they're aware that the pain is still there, but emotionally, they're not as bothered by it. They're not as engaged with it. They're not as upset by it. So like this one woman I talked to with trigeminal neuralgia, which is a very, very painful facial pain problem that they call it the suicide disease because it's so hard on people. Mm. She said she takes one puff and she feels like the pain steps about a foot off of her face. She knows it's there, but she can go about her job. And that's a common description for people using marijuana for pain, that they know it's there. They actually don't abuse it in general. They're taking it for pain. They're not taking it to get high. And many people find it very helpful.
Well, we did have a caller on the line who couldn't stay, and she was a massage therapist, and she thought that massage therapy is effective in managing pain, and it's less expensive than other medical treatment. Your thoughts on that?
Yes, I devote quite a bit of space in the book to massage and chiropractic. I mean, one of the complicating things with massage is that there's a bunch of different kinds, and it's not clear that any one kind of massage, like deep tissue or Swedish or whatever, is any better than any other kind. But yes, a lot of people do find it helpful, and the evidence does support that the idea that it can be helpful. Again, you know, it you have to keep doing it, and it may not be the slam dunk answer you're looking for, but absolutely, it can be very effective. It's not always cheap for people, though, and that's another issue is, you know, whether your insurance will pay for it, and a lot of times it won't.
Let's go next to Joe in Schofield. Hello, Joe.
Oh, hello. It's a good topic. When you said spondylolisthesis, it rung a bell with me because at first on my low back, they couldn't, you know, they said, oh, you have a couple, you know, high annular tears, which around the disc and some hypertrophy, which, you know, arthritis. But they said it's nothing that should be causing your pain. Well, then, you know, a doctor finally did an x-ray where I was bending over and he said, oh, you have spondylolisthesis. And what's that? And he said, we're moving forward of some of the vertebrae. And, you know, it's scary to have the surgery because you hear of horror stories of some of the outcomes, you know, with rods and screws and
yeah.
A few things I do to keep it, you know, I keep my weight down. I try to stay as hydrated as possible. on days when it flares up, I have a TENS unit that doesn't cure anything, but it does take the edge off. It's supposed to disrupt that pain highway, they say.
Yep.
It kind of. So those are a few things, you know. You know, and then when it's really bad, I get the, you know, I mean, I have oxycodone that's 3 months old, 4 months old, that, you know, I try to stay minimal because I think masking it sometimes, it doesn't do you any good. I think you just think, oh, hey, it's better. I'm going to go do this now. And then you're actually doing more damage because it's, you're not feeling it. And when the meds wear off, it's like, oh boy, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Well, it sounds like you're handling it really well. And I think you're basically right to be cautious about the surgery. I have, again, a pretty large chunk of the book, not of a chapter, on surgery. And in some cases, it's wonderful. And it's not exactly life-saving, but it's certainly quality of life-saving. But in many other cases, the surgery is not effective and can even make people worse, just as you said. I mean, there's a whole problem called failed back surgery syndrome. And so I think you're wise to be very cautious. A lot of times, like, I think what got my neck better was this intensive physical therapy and exercise program run by one of the hospitals here in Boston. And I felt safe doing it because it was run by physical therapists who knew what was going on. And they had me doing exercises that I thought would sever my spine. I mean, I was petrified. But it worked, and it works for a lot of people. The other thing that your story brings up is that people, especially with back and neck pain, it's hard to correlate what the person is feeling with what the MRIs or the x-rays show, because people can be in intense pain and their MRI, their magnetic resonance imaging scan, will look completely normal, in which case the doctor won't believe them. And in other cases, the back looks a mess on these scans and the person is fine. So there's definitely not a clear-cut correlation, which makes it very hard for people to be believed, patients to be believed, and very hard for doctors to figure out what's going on.
Yeah, what kinds of exercises are most effective? You wrote that exercise can be an effective pain management tool, and you even said it might be the best tool.
Yes, I think it is the best tool. But I would definitely, like in this caller's case, at least start out doing it under the supervision of a really good physical therapist, because they know which motions are likely to cause damage and which are safe. The big problem with exercise is this thing called kinesiophobia, which basically just means fear of movement. People with severe back and neck pain are often afraid to move. I was. And you think, oh, my God, that's the last thing I want to do. But, in fact, if you can get over that, moving is the thing that really can get you better. In terms of which type of exercise, it can be the whole range. Aerobic stuff can help. Walking is very, very good for a lot of people. Yoga helps some people, although, you know, you have to be careful. Some of the postures can actually cause problems, so go gingerly with that. Tai Chi is incredibly helpful for people with fibromyalgia, which is kind of pain all over the place, so your whole body. And a lot, you know, people, doctors who specialize in this say, you know, run, ski, walk, play games, you know, whatever, whatever works. I'm a swimmer, and that's wonderful. I had to give up swimming for about 8 months during the worst of my pain, but I'm back at it now. And, you know, anything that kind of gets your whole body moving is likely to be much more beneficial than harmful.
Next, we go to Karen in Madison. Hi, Karen. Karen, are you there? You know,
there she is. Yeah, sorry, I was on mute.
Yeah, so go ahead. You're on the air. Go ahead.
I was just calling to talk about the reality is that a lot of people I know with muscular dystrophy that use wheelchairs are in chronic pain all the time. And the biggest thing that they get is a lot of talk like, well, it's really not anything we can do about it. And then they give them something like a fentanyl patch and a ton of oxycodone or oxycontin and then go away because we don't want to deal with you.
Yeah.
They really structural problem. So I'll take my comment off the air.
Yeah, in other words, people get dismissed and sent away because they have pain and the doctors don't want to deal with them. Unfortunately, you're completely right. I mean, doctors often, in defense of doctors, and they feel helpless because they don't really, as I said earlier, they don't have the training in pain, and they don't usually have a whole arsenal of things to offer. You know, they don't really recommend acupuncture and massage and exercise and programs already set up to do that as much as they should. So they do write prescriptions for pills, and a lot of people don't want to take the pills. They would rather find some non-pharmacological way of dealing with their pain. But you're completely right. I mean, pain patients, I think, are in a way the most dreaded patient that doctors see, and they see a lot of them because a huge number of people go to their doctors because of the pain. As I said earlier, like it is the main reason people go to doctors. So you put your finger right on the main problem. But I would suggest, given that problem, keep on trying until you can find a doctor who does not dismiss you. I mean, I had to do that, and every other pain patient I've talked to has had to do that. And there are some doctors who really do know what they're doing and can advise you correctly, but it does take a lot of shopping around to find them.
So ultimately, you found that doctor, you got into some physical therapy, you got into an effective program, and you are now pain-free or what?
Pretty much. I mean, I wouldn't say 100%, but 95% is nirvana.
Yeah.
You know, I do get a lot of acupuncture. I do get a lot of massage. I exercise a ton. I swim 3 days a week and go to the gym 3 other days a week. And I really think it's that. And it's just sort of maintaining your normal life, trying to, you know, live your life despite the pain and not retreating, as is so tempting, to just being walled in and confined because of your pain. Could I just mention one website? And I have no financial ties to anybody,
sure,
including this website, but there's a very good group called the American Chronic Pain Association. And if you Google them, they have a lot of good tips for people on how to live with chronic pain and live with it, but not have it, you know, managing your whole life.
So do you live with chronic pain, or do you have a question for our guest about the management of chronic pain in this country? She says that it's not managed very well. She says it's probably the country's biggest health problem. She is the author of A Nation in Pain, and we welcome your calls at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Judy Foreman is also a nationally syndicated health columnist. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. Of all the things that affect us, pain is among the top reason that many of us go to the doctor, yet many doctors don't treat it effectively. It's according to our guest this hour, who says proper and effective pain management is a health care right we all deserve. Judy Foreman is the author of A Nation in Pain, Healing Our Biggest Health Problem. And our next caller is Ellen in Milwaukee. Hello, Ellen.
Good morning. My story is about my sister. Well, it's about myself, too, and my other siblings who helped care for her for the last 7 months. She went into the hospital with a necrotic infection. For anybody who knows about that, the surgery and the recovery was incredibly, horribly painful. It was like having a third-degree burn across her hip and rectal area. And the story with my sister is that when she was very young, at 13 years old, she began taking IV drugs. She had a very tragic history as a child, and this is what she did to get away from it. She quit that habit when she was in her 20s, and she quit it with the aid of the methadone program, which is a very strictly guarded program. And she got herself down to an absolutely minuscule amount of methadone. When she needed to be transferred from the hospital where she was given the surgery, no hospital, there were there was one hospital in Chicago that would take her, and that was Kindred, and that is related to the Kindred that was shut down here due to violations. My sister was given almost no physical therapy there, very poor nutrition, despite my sister and I being there 4 days a week, and we had battles every single day, and they were mostly about pain. My sister, having been an addict, wanted to stay as far away as she could from pain medicine, but when she did need it, she was not given it. She was given very, very, very small amounts of various things that did not help her at all.
I'm so sorry, Ellen, for your loss, your situation your sister.
What's the story right now?
Go ahead.
No,
the story is that my sister died on February 2nd after going through 7 months of not a day without horrendous pain. Like I said, it was all due to the hospital's great fear, it seems, to take patients who have methadone among medicines that they take.
So someone who's was a heroin addict, a recovering heroin addict, was denied, I guess, pain relief for a very, very, you know, serious situation. Judy Foreman, any thoughts on that?
God, I mean, that is just heartbreaking and outraging. I mean, that should not happen in America in 2014. I mean, I'm just appalled. I can't say I'm totally shocked, but I am appalled. And I don't want to urge legal action, but I mean, I think that's a very clear-cut kind of situation that I wish the public knew more about, because it is true that the hardest patients for doctors to treat are people who are both addicts and pain patients, because it is a very delicate thing. But doctors who are expert in pain management know how to do that. And it is tricky. Methadone is a very tricky drug, by the way. And, a good third of the overdose deaths in this country are due to methadone, because it's very easy to, outside of a program like your sister was in, it's very easy, if you're using it for pain, to overdose, because the effect wears off before it's out of your body. And so people keep thinking, oh, I got to take more, and then they end up taking too much. But the fact that the hospital would not adequately treat her pain because she had been an addict, to me, that is absolutely inexcusable. Absolutely inexcusable. And I don't know if this was the case in your family, but it's worth mentioning that the suicide rate for people in chronic pain is twice that for people without pain, because when they can't get their pain under control, life is just a living hell. And that is something that almost never gets brought out either, because we're so obsessed with this drug abuse epidemic that we're really failing to address the needs of pain patients, and especially the needs of people who have a history of addiction and have current pain. So I'm just outraged and appalled by this situation.
Ellen, I'm sorry again for your loss. Thank you for calling. Rick in La Crosse is with us. Hello, Rick.
Good morning. How are you today?
Good. What is your story or question?
Well, my story is that about 8 years ago, I went through a series of about 3 or 4 back surgeries and ended up with failed back syndrome.
Oh. Yeah.
And so I have been on OxyContin and all those kinds of things. And I found that while it helped the pain, it made me depressed.
Yeah.
And so I had a spinal cord stimulator implanted, mm-hmm. which was largely helpful. And what that allowed me to do was to get back to exercising,
mm-hmm.
and to get off the pain medications. And I had that stimulator put in about 4 years ago, and that was a miracle for me. Absolutely, I exercise every day. I walk about 5 miles a day. I do a lot of stretching. I'm able to be engaged at work full-time with my family and friends. So I just wanted to say that was a long, long road for me, but I had doctors who really understood what was happening and they understood I did not want to take drugs. And this option did the trick. And I just wanted to share that.
Do you know about these stimulators?
Oh, I'm so glad you did. Yeah, that's just that's as inspiring as the previous story was upsetting. I mean, and you're completely, everything rings true to me that all these back surgeries put together leave the person often with failed back syndrome. The spinal cord stimulators, I mean, it's a little bit of an invasive procedure to put it in, but it can be very effective. And as you say, that the result of that is you can exercise, which is hugely effective, and you're doing a lot, 5 miles a day, that's great. And you know, you're doing all the right things. And I think that's such a hopeful story because, you know, you're really much more like the typical pain patient who does not want to take the drugs, only use them as a last resort, and you've really taken things into your own hands and are, you know, taking care of your pain in the most effective, productive way. So this is great. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, thank you, Rick. The spinal cord stimulator, is this a common technique?
It's actually been around in various forms for a number of years. I think it should be used much more. It's a surgical procedure to put it in. It can be very effective. It isn't always effective. I have a section in my book about it, and if I were in the situation this caller was in, I would probably opt for that myself. I think it can be, you know, it's definitely worth a try. One reason it isn't used more is because some of the drug companies really are pushing the drugs as the solution, and a lot of people with pain would really rather not be on these drugs. So I think the spinal cord stimulator is a terrific option with the caveat that it also doesn't always work.
I talked somewhat recently with a back specialist about a study that came out that said if most lower back pain, anyway, was something that would go away after a certain period of time and it did not require surgery. So we know this, that we shouldn't put people under the knife right away, right?
That is completely correct, yes. And a lot of the lower back problems get better on their own in X amount of time, a matter of weeks. And I've certainly had that myself, and it can be really very painful. You know, you sort of lie down on the floor with your legs up trying to get rid of the pain, and then you think, how am I going to get off the floor? But yes, and once the acute period is over, walking and exercising, you know, gently and sort of judiciously, but that is what gets a lot of people much, much better.
And this is because we're strengthening our core and that sort of thing, and that's why our pain goes away?
Yes, that's part of the reason. Walking also can increase circulation in and near the spine. That helps too. Mentally, it helps for people to get up and move, and there's a big overlap between pain and depression, and the exercise can help make a person feel more like they're doing their regular life. Yes, through a number of mechanisms, it can really help.
You mentioned in the book these drugs that act on specialized immune cells. You pronounce it glial cells?
Glial, G-L-I-A-L. It literally means glue. These are cells that come from the immune system, but they live in the nervous system. And we were talking a little bit earlier about how the nervous system revs up with chronic pain. It gets better and better and better at passing pain signals up to the brain so that you end up feeling much more pain, and it becomes like a runaway train. It turns out that these immune-derived cells, these glial cells, actually a subtype called microglia, they contribute to this revving up process. So you actually have nerve cells and these immune-derived cells both working in concert to rev up the pain, which is sort of, on the surface of it, really bad news. But scientifically, it's good news because the more we understand the contribution of these immune cells, the more that provides another target for drugs. Because if you can have a drug that stops the contribution of these glial cells, then you would have to rely less on opioids to control the pain. So it's scientifically a very good development. So far, there's no really great drugs that have come up to the market based on that, but there's a lot of research activity on that.
Let's go to Jerry in Menominee next. Hello, Jerry.
Hello, Joy, and good morning.
Morning.
Standing here looking out the barn window expecting a whole pile of snow.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jerry.
I've got ankylosing spondylitis and psoriasis, and I've been fighting with pain since I was a teenager. And I just want to say, one of my early doctors said, avoid surgery, period. And some of the things I've done are, when I first got rid of sugar, that was a huge, huge improvement, a 30% in pain reduction. Then I reduced simple carbs, and recently went on a gluten-free diet. Each of these things cuts the pain. Also, omega-3 eggs, when they came out, I was able to get rid of the symptoms of psoriasis. It took about 3 weeks, and the psoriasis symptoms just disappeared.
Jerry, because we're running short on time, let me ask our guest, Judy Foreman, how does diet affect pain?
Well, as you might expect, since we spend so little on research on pain, that has been not too well researched, although I've heard other people saying the same thing, that when they cut down on sugar and even gluten, it helps. The thing that makes the most sense to me about what you said is the omega-3, because that is an anti-inflammatory, and there are different kinds of pain, but inflammatory pain, like for arthritis and psoriasis, you know, anything you can do to cut down on the basic inflammatory state of the body, that will help. So what you said makes a lot of sense to me. You know, the data on all this stuff is mixed, but that certainly makes a lot of sense to me, and I do talk about that in the book.
Yeah, and you do mention how we need to spend more money on research when it comes to pain management. What, anything on the horizon? What do you think should be that first study?
Oh, well, not a study per se, but a really coordinated allocation. I think basically Congress, if it could get its act together, would give the National Institutes of Health a much bigger mandate to deal with pain. There are a couple of little committees trying to get the word out based on this Institute of Medicine report. They don't have much money either, and that's, you know, it's a huge problem because we spend so little on pain research compared to cancer and diabetes and heart disease, and yet pain is the bigger problem. So I think, you know, political action ultimately is a big thing, but that's asking a lot of people in pain to also get active.
Yeah, what about doctors and their training? How can we do that more effectively so they can diagnose and treat pain more effectively?
Yeah, that's huge. There are a couple of programs in the country that do it well, like Johns Hopkins does it pretty well, and I, again, have no ties to there. I think you could use the carrot and the stick, and the stick would be to test students' knowledge, students graduating from medical schools, about basic pain mechanisms, and if they flunk, then you withdraw the accreditation of medical schools. I mean, that's a harsh idea, but that has been proposed, and basically when you start testing about something, schools start teaching it. So that is one avenue.
Somebody that's suffering from some chronic pain right now as they're listening and is not having it, you know, treated effectively, what general advice might you have for them?
Don't give up. Go to the American Chronic Pain Association website. Keep finding till you find a doctor who really believes you, believes that you're in pain, believes that you're not a drug seeker, and do everything, you know, not just drugs, but do the exercise, do the acupuncture, do the massage, do a pain support group. I went to one just to watch a couple of weeks ago. It was incredibly helpful to people because obviously by the numbers, you are not alone, but you probably feel alone. And if you're depressed as well as having pain, get the depression treated as well.
And finally, how can patients demand this kind of high quality attention and care to their problem?
I think partly by going public. Whenever you see a story on TV or on the radio or in the newspaper talking about drug addiction, call the news organization and say, you know, you're only getting half the story. There are a lot of people in pain out there. Why don't you write about us? Why don't you talk about us? Make it the public issue that it should be, given the numbers.
Thank you very much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Judy Foreman is a nationally syndicated health columnist and author of A Nation in Pain, Healing Our Biggest Health Problem. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster for producing and directing this program. Thanks to Christy Taylor for on-air production. And thank you for listening. I hope you are with us tomorrow at this time. It's our Week in Review. We'll have two guests from different political perspectives talking about the top stories in politics this week, including the end of the state legislative session and all of the issues that we voted on when we went to the polls this week. That's our Week in Review every Friday at this time. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.